afternoon, everybody. This is Debbie Q with The Right Shoe. The Right Shoe is a podcast about all things strange and unusual, especially in reference to a death. My microphone is swinging to and fro. I can't get it straight. Good Lord. Let's try to fix this. All right. Okay, I was paying attention to my dog. My buddy went far away, but now I have little Coco. She's just the best. I was originally going to do... Oh, God, this thing. I was originally... I'm having technical difficulties. Oh, my God. Call the police. Okay. Well, I'm just going to have to make do with this very fucking whack. Okay, I think I'm okay. Okay, originally, The Right Shoe is a podcast. Oh, I got a new email. TheRightShoe65@gmail.com. Yay! That's TheRightShoe65@gmail.com. The Right Shoe podcast, I think when I had that website and it was like tied to that email, something Google, I don't know, eradicated it. So whatever. See ya, Google. I just made a new one. I didn't want to use my dad's. Anyway, The Right Shoe is here. Same old, you know, the week's just plugging along. That horrible story about the German tattoo artist who was killed by Palestinian Hamas. She was kidnapped on TV and they showed everything. Then she was raped, murdered, and tied to the back of a truck half naked when she was dead and had people like spit at her as they paraded her through the streets. She wasn't even a person of Israel. I mean, come on, people. They're idiots. They really are idiots. Oh my God, every time I come into this room, my nose runs. I'm going to spray my lucky guest spray. I've had it since I started the podcast. Oh, here comes Cokie. Cokie Roberts. I know, you want to play. We don't have time to play. I got to do this. Okay, originally I was going to do two stories, but there's a lot of information on this first one. So next week I'll be doing... It's almost like... Kind of. Not, it is almost like, but there's similarities and differences to the Maura Murray case, which is so complex. I do want to do that at one point, but there's such material on that, and there's a lot of stuff that's not true out there, so I really would like to take my time with that. I want to do so much, and I will just go with the flow. The next episode is definitely going to be the Christy Krebs case. Very, very interesting. But tonight, I'm going to do the Jean Tavari case. It's spelled Jean Tavari. I think it's Tavari. That's how most people pronounce it. T-O-V-R-E-A. It looks like Tovria, but I heard Tavari. It was on Unsolved Mysteries. I'll just start from the beginning. Her name was Jean Gunter. She was from Slalom Springs. I hope I'm pronouncing these right. Slalom Springs, Arkansas. She had bounced around from state to state with her brother and parents since her youth and continued to do so well into her adulthood. She and her family landed in Oregon after graduating from high school in 1950. And she married a man named Stan Nolan. They had their first child, their first and only child, named Deborah. Jean's marriage to Stan was short-lived and ended in divorce soon after her daughter's birth. Jean found single parenthood a challenge, but she did what she had to do, and she was really traveling around with her daughter. She held down jobs. Mostly, they portrayed her as being mostly a waitress. Yeah, it was one of her biggest jobs. She remarried after her first divorce. It didn't really say how long they were married. Daniel Daniels, what a name. And he was, allegedly a professional gambler, was murdered. That is really strange. In the early 60s, Jean found work as a cocktail waitress. Okay, this is where I'm more familiar with the Jean that I knew of. Jean was a cocktail waitress in Arizona, and then she moved back to her native Arkansas for a few years. She had cervical cancer. Cervical cancer, if caught early, is extremely easy to cure if caught early. So everyone, all women, go to their GYN because pap smear as well. Very uncomfortable and annoying. It's so necessary. Just get one every 1 to 3 years. If it's negative, every 3 years is fine. It's like colon cancer. If caught early, it's very easy to treat. So she came back. She returned to Arizona. She wanted to sell real estate. She had such an outgoing personality that the real estate industry would have been much more suited to the way she was. She probably would have done well because she was very outgoing and people liked her. She had charisma. So she was determined to succeed. And during the 1970s, she was introduced to the man who would become the love of her life. And that was Ed Tavari. He was a powerful man. This guy, he was in World War II. He actually was captured by the Nazis and held for a couple years. Desperate to be free again, he and some of his fellow inmates planned what was known now as the Great Escape. Now, it says here that the Germans moved him before he was able to escape. But I thought that in Unsolved Mysteries, they said that his plan for this escape actually led people. There was like 40 or something amount, a large amount of number that did escape. But here, it's conflicting that. So he returned to Arizona after his release. He got out of the army, and his family had owned a very large meat packing plant, and they were huge in the cattle business. So Ed never lacked for money, and he was smart. So whatever his family had started, he cultivated and was really big in this meat packing industry. That's when he enlisted to the army. Now, I swore they said he was, I don't know. So that's conflicting. This particular paper said that he never made the Great Escape. Unsolved Mysteries made it seem like he did do an escape plan, and it worked for him and others. Regardless, he came home to Arizona, and he took control of his family's businesses, and he expanded them and even added a booming banking chain. This was from Dominic Dunn. He was, if anybody who watched the beginning of cable, Dominic Dunn was huge with the Mysteries of the Famous. He was really good, actually. He was a big reporter. His daughter was actually, I think Dominique Dunn was her name. She was the older sister in Poltergeist who was murdered by her boyfriend. That's why Dominic Dunn started doing all of those mystery shows. Was directly a direct result from his daughter being killed by her boyfriend. I could do a whole story on that. So in 1947, Ed Tavari married Priscilla Peterson, who also came from a prominent area family. Over the next 7 years, the couple had three children, Georgia, Edward, and Priscilla, who they called Cricket. Hap and Prissy. Edward was Hap, Georgia was Cricket, Priscilla was Prissy. They divorced in 1965, and the children remained with their mother. Ed married in 1969, but the couple lasted less than a year. For a while, it seemed like he would just be a wealthy, eligible bachelor. However, in 1970, he met a divorced mother from Arkansas named Jean Gunter, who would change all of that. Now, you can see on these pictures that Jean was just, you know, effervescent. They look so beautiful together because I guess the children, as soon as she had married Ed, all the children, Hap, Prissy, and Cricket, they didn't like Jean. They always thought that she was out for his money, Ed's money. But he was a big social guy in Arizona. So they were smitten with each other, and they married in 1973. Gene was blue collar and Ed came from a wealthy background. Yet, as people became more knowing of Gene, they realized that she really loved her husband. I mean, they fit together. And this one guy, he's a very likable guy on Unsolved Mysteries. He talks about how Gene was so well liked by the people in Arizona, the Arizona socialites.
She seemed to fall right into it, as if though she'd had that money forever. She was welcomed and very, very well loved. Extremely liked. I don't know of one, and I can honestly say this, I don't know one person that disliked Jeannie. She was just one of those very special people with very special qualities.
So I don't believe the children that she was this money grubbing hustler. You can just see in the pictures the love. You can tell when people love each other, even in pictures. It screams out. And it really does. I really believe that. I mean, I know you can fake it, but not only was there pictures, but these people here, like the society, Danny Medina, people loved her. I don't think you can fake it that much. Ed's kids just did not like her. They thought she was squandering their inheritance. There was a lot of tension there. Now, also, her daughter, Deborah, the one daughter that she had stake in this because she was the sole beneficiary of Jeannie's life insurance policy. So this is all leading up to, through their marriage, they had a great marriage, but there was one thing that was really tragic about this, and Ed became sick. I guess from his POW days, he had a respiratory problem, and in 1982, he really became sick, and this is so crushing, because I really think that they were like soulmates, and then she took care of him. She nursed him round the clock when he became sick.
How about a little soup?
Jeannie, I think it's about time we talked about what you're going to do after I'm gone.
Ed, please don't talk that way.
I just want to make sure you're taken care of, you get the house, and you're comfortable. Okay?
I mean, that was on Unsolved Mysteries about, you know, nobody was in there, but it's probably what did happen, because if they truly loved each other, of course he's going to want to make sure that Jeannie has whatever she needs. In the background, you know, there's children lurking and others that are jealous, and money is the root of all evil. So after he dies and she's devastated, but she moves on and she becomes the society's upper crust again. She doesn't want to just go down with Ed's death. She wants to revel in what good life has to offer.
I think it was her way to get over everything and meet people. Became quite the socialite and chaired many of the balls, and her circle of friends all went. So it became a very, for Jean, it became a way of doing things for herself.
So March 31st, 1988, she's talking to her sister and she's about to throw another party and she's writing out the invitations and everything was fine and dandy. By 1 a.m. that morning, she would be dead. And this is where the mystery truly begins. Ed had actually contemplated cutting his kids out of his will completely before he died because he said they were acting like crazy people, like bitter little children about his money. They were constantly being very hard on Gene and it really pissed him off. The trust fund that he had could only be collected and split after Gene's death. Gene, on the other hand, received more than $8 million plus the interest generated on the kids' trust fund, which was like $400,000 a year. I mean, they were just furious. Prissy, Happ, and Cricket launched four lawsuits against Gene. Ed's demand prevailed, and the kids lost each lawsuit. And they had to pay Gene back for her legal costs, so they're furious. And she tried to repair the relationship with them again and again, and she was so upset by their attacks. It really seems shitty. Gene was devastated when, she severed all contacts with the kids. Happ, who was Edward, they called him Happ, I think he was the worst of the three. He was a failed entrepreneur, always in need of money. So all this is going on. And then March 31st, 1988 comes. And she was actually talking to her sister and making plans for another party when she was murdered at 1 a.m. in the morning. And this is interesting. She had mailed the invitations to that party before she was murdered.
She had mailed those invitations, and then they came right after we found out that she had been murdered. And it did do a number on all of us. It was almost like Remember My Party. It was very spooky.
I mean, you know, they come in, and she was... It's really messed. I mean, it is downright spooky how she was murdered. Somebody broke in to her house that night. It was a gated community. They made their way on foot. The intruder carefully removed a 24-inch kitchen window, the only window not protected by the security system, climbed through it, and navigated through the darkened house to the master bedroom, yanked the cord out from the telephone, grabbed a pillow, put it over Jean's head, and at point-blank range shot her execution style 5 times in the head with a .22 caliber gun while she lay sleeping. The killer then rummaged through Jean Tavari's bedroom, her jewelry box, and her purse before fleeing the scene through a sliding glass door. The opening of the door did trigger the security alarm, which caught the attention of the community service guards, who called the police. Police arrived with a dog named Bear, and a canine dog. He sniffed his way into Jean's home. He scratched at the master bedroom, and when officers opened the door, the dog jumped on the bed. They pulled back the pillow and found Jean in a pool of blood. They thought it was a burglary gone wrong, but nothing was really taken. It was staged to look like a burglary. That is when the mystery started, and that's when they go through the whole, you know, story about how she was blue collar and she started going out with Ed. The kids didn't like her, and even her own daughter would be under suspicion. In fact, when I was reading Reddit posts about this, somebody posted, "Why don't you look at Deborah and stop looking at Hap?" And it's like, and everyone was like, "Because Hap's the one who did this." I mean, that just sticks in my head. And I was like, you know, they're like, "Follow the money," but follow the money where? It was either one or the other. Both kids got what they needed, but Deborah would, I think, was, I just don't think it was Deborah. I think she was fine. Either way, it seemed like this Hap was in desperate need of money. Now, this is where the story gets so weird. Several weeks after her mother's murder, Deborah, the daughter, stumbled upon an answer machine tape while cleaning her mother's home. It was left by a man named Gordon Phillips. Now, I'm going to play you the answer machine message. Now, in first glance, because Ed was a POW, you would assume, okay, I mean, this guy came to Jean asking about Ed's POW days and wanted to talk to her. And she kept saying, "I don't, you know, we would have to talk to Ed, and he doesn't live in the past." It had been going on quite some time. I'm not sure it was after his death or when he was still alive, but she said, "I really don't know much about those days. You would have to talk to his first wife." That's what she had said. 1 year, this is how it started. 1 year prior to her death, Phillips had called Jean claiming to be a freelance reporter for Time Life, expressing interest about Ed's World War II experiences. Jean was suspicious from the get-go because he never had any, he didn't have any credentials. She called about him, and Time Life was like, "We don't have anybody named Gordon Phillips working for us, even freelance." So he persisted until Jean finally gave in a request to meet him in Newport Beach, California. Jean and her daughter sat down with Phillips at a restaurant, and she even brought some of Ed's World War II memorabilia. He showed little interest in this, so her suspicions grew. She became frightened of him because she actually asked one of her friends, a retired CIA agent, to check Gordon out. He had no ties to Time Life, and he was always there. She saw him a lot. Detectives worked to try to find out who Gordon Phillips was. As the years passed, it seemed like her murder would never be solved. In 1992, Unsolved Mysteries aired an episode about Jean. They showed the tape of Gordon Phillips. The initial airing of the show elicited little response. However, a rerun of the episode, Detective Ed Reynolds got his first big break. 1993, an anonymous caller who was later identified as an ex-FBI agent, Jeff Favre, called the police in Phoenix, Arizona, and reported that he believed the killer was a man named James C. Harrod, 39, nicknamed Butch. The caller stimulated Reynolds' interest in the case, and unbeknownst to Reynolds at the time of the call, Favre was actually a family friend of Harrod's wife, Anne, who was newly separated from him. So it all came together. They recognized Harrod's voice. The investigation received yet another call in September 1994 when an anonymous person claimed that Harrod told Anne that he had been involved in Jean's murder. Anne allegedly found a letter from Harrod to Hap Tavari, which promised $50,000 to kill Jean. Harrod also allegedly admitted to Anne that he posed as Gordon Phillips. He wasn't the killer, but he was present at the murder. The caller turned out to be a close friend of Anne's who believed it was time for the truth to come out about Jean's death. At the time, Anne had been divorced from Harrod for more than a year and a half, and she was tired of the secret. This all brought about to research more and more. There was 1,500 phone calls made between the two men prior to the murder, and 52 of those calls took place the day before the murder. As evidence began to accumulate, they said it was time to talk with Anne. November 28, 1994, Reynolds, the detective, met with Anne, and she would be granted immunity. When she assumed that she wouldn't end up behind, in jail, she told the truth. In the interview, she revealed that Harrod, Hap, and his sisters hated Jean for spending their money, that was their terms, and they agreed to hire a hitman, promised to pay him $100,000, and Anne further claimed that Harrod, that night, dressed in camouflage and hiking boots, left their home with a duffel bag and guns inside the duffel bag. Upon his departure, she allegedly checks to see if the guns were in the place where they were kept and they were missing. When he came back, they were there. So he had taken them with him. At around 2 a.m. the night of the murder, Anne said that Harrod came and woke her. He said he did it. There was two hitmen involved, and Harrod had paid the hitman a portion of the money. He was angry that Hap only paid him $40,000, which was less than half the money they had asked for. And the police discovered that Hap and Harrod were acquainted since 1987. They just never made any money. They always had these big schemes that never went anywhere. There was really no evidence connecting Hap directly to Jean's murder. So they arrested Harrod since the evidence against him was much more solid. After presenting some of what they knew, they were hoping that he would implicate Hap, but he never did. On September 14, 1995, police arrested Harrod. He was taken to Phoenix Police Department, and he said, Reynolds' goal was to try and get Harrod to confess. Now, he showed him the answer machine, and Harrod said that wasn't him. Throughout the interview, Harrod seemed he was in shock about these allegations about him. He had little reaction, unruffled when Reynolds presented the biggest thing of all, which was the 18 sets of fingerprints found at the crime scene, which matched his. Instead of a confession, he said he was not the killer and that he had no idea how his fingerprints turned up there. He said he had an alibi. He said he had a couple of beers and snorted cocaine that night. he claimed Anne woke him up, turned and saw him, but turned back over and went to sleep. Harrod's alibi concerning Anne was never substantiated because it directly conflicted with her testimony. The man with whom he allegedly met on the night in question was never found. So it's hard. Although the fingerprints are a big thing. He made a lot of excuses why he couldn't be the murderer. He said that Anne's family hated him so bad they were just making lies up about him. They turned their focus on Hap, which also he vehemently denied the murder, and he diminished his relationship with Harrod, even though they talked on the phone, you know, so much. So they were sure of it, but it was, you know, it's really hard getting a conviction. He did go on trial. He pleaded not guilty. Anne did come, and she was one of the prosecution's witnesses. She said that Harrod received packages through the mail containing large sum of cash or checks. Jean's answer machine tape was Harrod's voice. Deborah Nolan Luster, her Jean's daughter, took the stand and pointed out to jurors that Harrod was the man who claimed to be Gordon Phillips. When she was on vacation, that's who she met. He was heavier and wearing glasses, but she knew that was the man. Deborah was challenged by the defense because she had earlier failed to pick Butch Harrod's photo in a photo lineup. However, she did pick him out of a physical lineup in 1996, which photos can, you know, it's, I would, you know, if she picked him out in person, it would sway me. Ultimately, Harrod could not get past the fingerprints, which was hugely against him. Plus Anne being there, Deborah saying she had met him, it really didn't look good. It only took 3.5 hours for the jury to come back with a guilty first-degree murder. You know, it's a shame, though, that Hap was never, they could never get him. Oh, you know what? I might be able to do the Christy Krebs case. That was the Jean Tavari case. I don't want to go on with it too long because I would like to tell at least a surfacey thing about Christy Krebs. Just so that I really want to get into other cases. I have a lot that I want to do. But that to me was a really good mystery. Look up Jean. It's T-O-V-R-E-A. I think Jean Tavari. My mouth doesn't move that way. So Tavari is the easiest for me to pronounce. That was a great mystery. I mean, it's horrible that they actually killed this one. It's money. I mean, money just makes that evil world go around. So I'm just going to go over Christy Krebs real quick. It really reminded me of the Maura Murray case. All right, this poor girl. December 29th, 1970, Christy Krebs, blue-eyed brown hair. She had a deformed right thumb that is thick at the knuckle with the tip of the thumb curving inward. So if anyone ever saw her, they said use this thumb. That would be a really major characteristic because she's still considered missing, even though she has been disappeared. She's been disappeared since about August 9th, 1993. I'll just give you a real quick overview of what happened. It's really fascinating. Okay, so on August 10th, 1993, in Redwood Forest, Mendocino, California, a car was found stuck in the mud. The radio had been ripped out. There were small traces of blood on the dashboard and the front seat, along with shredded identification papers. A few torn up photographs were scattered nearby. The photos, the papers, and the car were all traced to 22-year-old Christy Krebs. She had worked as a chef just 7 miles from where her car was found. Her parents said the scene was all too familiar. She had graduated from high school in 1989. She went to work in a full-time restaurant. She was very cheerful and upbeat, but she had become very infatuated with a married man, obsessed with him. Now, this is what's weird. On April 30th, 1990, 3 years before her disappearance, Christy apparently began to fantasize about marrying this man. She drove around in a few of euphoric days for hours, losing her way on a country road. Her car became hopelessly stuck in the mud, then burst into flames. When found, the interior had been destroyed and Kirstie was nowhere to be found. Now, it never said, like, was this man showing interest in her? It never said that, but she must have had some kind of, like, not bipolar, but to get that obsessed, you know, to the point where you're, like, crazily driving around thinking about this guy or that you're going to marry him and blah-bitty-blah. Like, it's so crazy to me. I mean, it's a shame. It's just, it made me really sad. I don't know. She just got into a fixation. So the morning after this incident, when her car had burst into flames, railroad workers saw a dazed and disoriented young woman wandering along the tracks. The car fire had apparently sent Kirstie into a mental breakdown. One of the men recognized Kirstie and called her parents. Bob Krebs is Kirstie's father, and this is what he said.
Initially, we thought things were okay, but as we were driving back into town, the behavior we were getting from her was very bizarre, chanting and patting her, doing very weird things. And I just looked at my wife and said, we're not going home, we're going to the hospital. I remember in the examining room, she was still acting very, very strange. And for the first week to 10 days at least, she was really incoherent.
We wondered if she was ever going to be the same again. At first, they thought that she might have been on drugs, but they were able to test her and see that there were no drugs in her system.
That was Kirstie's mother. I mean, that must be terrifying to parents to see this. Over the next few months, Kirstie was in and out of the hospital. She was diagnosed as having a psychotic trauma-related break. After therapy and drug treatment, she made rapid progress. After 6 months, things were looking up. Kirstie was released from the hospital. Her therapist recommended that she go back to work, but just only part-time, like maybe 20 hours a week. The problem was she started working 10 to 12 hours a day. I think she was a manic depressive because it seems like she would go on a, you know, spazzing out on mania and then dip down into this depression. 3 years went by and her parents were frantic about her pace. Yet she kept insisting she was okay right up to the night she disappeared. August 9th, 1993, Kirstie left work in high spirits. She even told her manager that she, like, he was like, what's so, because he said she looked so happy that day. And I was like, what's going on? She's like, oh, I'm just in a great mood. She didn't go straight home, though. She drove around until at some point she veered onto a dirt road. Well, actually, where she went, first, she went to a nearby public beach first, where a ranger spotted her.
Everything okay?
Yeah, I just came from work to relax here, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure you knew this wasn't an overnight lot.
Yeah. Is it okay if I stay here for a while?
The ranger just wanted to make sure that she knew that she couldn't stay there. She had to leave. So she was driving around on this high again. Well, what happened is when she drove back, I guess, to go home, she veered onto this dirt road 7 miles from where her car had previously been set on fire 3 years ago. Once again, in the Redwoods, her car got stuck in the mud and she couldn't get out. Her father truly believes she went onto another psychotic break, which I totally agree with.
She then went from there back through Fort Bragg, traveling south, and headed toward the town of Mendocino. I think that she probably had flashbacks to 1990. It was like reliving that nightmare, and all of that, I think, just overloaded all the circuits.
The authorities think that before she abandoned her car, she changed into a gym outfit. Her work clothes were found sopping wet and neatly folded on the back seat. The next morning, a full-scale search was launched, but there was no trace of her. However, over the next few months, several sightings were reported in Texas, Salt Lake City, Utah, and California. June 30th, 1994, just outside a farming town of Visalia, California, an off-duty highway worker named Mike Case picked up a hitchhiker who looked like Christy. He said it was 300 miles south of the spot where the car was abandoned.
It seemed to me that she didn't have it all there. At first, I thought possibly she was on some type of drugs. But talking with her a little bit at the beginning, I knew that possibly she was in a world of her own.
That's Mike Case, who was the last credible sighting of Christy. Not sure if it was really her or not.
Your wrist there.
I did happen to notice that on her wrist, there was 2 slash marks on her wrist. And I asked her directly, I said, well, what happened there? And she said, I had a breakdown.
Had a boyfriend. He wasn't very nice.
So they don't know. I mean, there's been sightings. He dropped her off at an intersection near Hanford, California. A week later, he read about Christy in an article, contact her parents. Christy's mother at the time was hopeful that she's alive. Christy's parents now believe one of the most credible sightings is from a woman who picked up a girl hitchhiking between Salt Lake City and Park City, Utah. The woman was able to describe details about her clothing that had never been released to the public. That's when you can really be assured that, you know, people are being honest. That's the best thing, is when they do hold certain things back. Not everything, but. So Christy Krebs has never been seen since 1993. I mean, at the time, she was born in 1970, so she would be 53 now, but she could still be alive. I mean, there was that one case on Unsolved Mysteries. It was about, gosh, I don't remember her name, but she had an illness, and she couldn't remember things, and she would just wander away from home. She was gone from her home from like 33 years, and they found her. Her sister had been looking for her and her ex-husband. And God, I wish I, let me see if I can figure out the name of that. Patricia Carlton. Yeah, that was a real shame. Her sister, Marianne, did actually, she had been missing since 1971. And she was found, God, 2005 or 2004, she had been found. Husband Troy passed away in 1997, never having seen her again. But her sister, God bless, was alive for 1 year, 33 years, and they found her. So it's possible. So those were 2 interesting stories that I'd seen. I do want to do all my deep dives. It's time. You know, and as much as it seems like day to day, oh, time, it's never going to happen, or I'm running out of time. You know what? There's always time. As long as you're alive, there is always time. So who knows? In 10 years, I might semi-retire. Then I'll have all the time in the world to do all of these mysteries. So I'm always going to keep it open. Even if I miss a few weeks or whatever, it will always be here. I will always be here. therightshoe65@gmail.com. Go on my Instagram, therightshoe_podcast_. If you're having trouble with heroin, I would gladly talk to you about anything you need help with. Just get in touch with me. If you have a subject that you wanted to hear, I, you know, don't worry. I will get to all of this. Everything is written down and plan on getting to it. Even if it takes a while, I will always be here until my death. The Right Shoe will be alive. Keep that in mind. It's just been a little crazy right now. But this is Debbie K with The Right Shoe. And it's getting cold outside, which I hate. I am a summer baby. I love the heat. I never complain about the heat. Get as hot as you want. I just do not like the cold at all. Have a great night, and I will see you soon.